The Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra is one of those wonderful orchestral aspects that we've been delighted to cover over the years. And even though normally we're in the studio and we're playing some of the wonderful Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra material, and then we lead into various other factors, clearly times have changed. So actually we find ourselves still separated, socially distanced from Los Angeles through to actually Teesside as opposed to Lincoln these days. But it's still a delight to be able to welcome to the airwaves the awesomely talented director, of course, of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, the wonderful Ben Cadwallader. How are you, Ben?
Hello, Alex. I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. As I say, it was a nice, pleasant surprise where I have to say, I'm always saying to my students, look, ensure that you're punctual. The punctuality of your good self, Ben, 7 days ahead of time in the waiting room, ready for this meeting. That impresses me. That shows you good to go. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I try to be ahead of the curve whenever I can, so I'm glad I didn't disappoint.
I tell you, Libby and company at New York System, they'll be delighted with respect to that, but let's move
good.
On. Ben, clearly, I'd have to say you need to be off the planet completely not to appreciate the huge impact that coronavirus has actually had on the globe in terms of the arts industries in particular. I think one of those interesting lines we've talked about in the past is that you've got an interesting line with the United States and then Britain having the sort of top two lists of casualties and fatalities from coronavirus. Mm-hmm. There are challenges there, whether we're talking about our mini Trump, your genuine Trump. Let's not go there. It's a different line entirely.
No, exactly.
And let's not bring in the Brazilian president either, because that's another issue. But having said that, your timing was certainly on one hand immaculate, but also you must have thought when you took up the post in terms of looking after the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, well, thank you, universe. This is a real fun time to take over.
Well, yes, that's true to some extent, Alex. I think, so for context, I started this, well, the process for this job started last September. I was offered the job in December 2019, and then I actually started here in March. And I kid you not, my first day in the office was March 9th. That was a Monday. And the last day in the office was the following Monday. That was the day that we closed the office. So everything else since then has been through this medium, through screen. And so on one hand, I agree with the characterization that, excited to take on this new job with this wonderful organization, you pointed out at the top, this wonderful history, and then the world just shuts down and burns. So that of course, is a disappointment in one way, but I'm a relentless optimist. And I make the argument that of any time in the tenure of a leader at an organization like LACO, to encounter a catastrophic and existential threat of this magnitude, the beginning is probably a good time for it. I am not coming in to this job with preconceived notions of how things are supposed to run. I'm not coming into this job with a fully formed and clearly articulated vision for how I'd like to see this organization evolve with Jaime Martin, our music director. Those things are being crafted in real time as we creatively respond and optimistically respond to this pandemic. So there are moments when I certainly agree with the characterization of, why, universe, would you saddle this, with me? I show up here and then this happens. But more often than not, I find myself in a strange position of gratitude isn't the right word, but I feel uniquely positioned with the stellar team at LACO, with Jaime Martin, our music director, to take this challenge by the horns and soldier through in a way that our fervent hope is we will come out of this a stronger, more relevant, more exciting organization than we were even just a few months ago.
I mean, I would have said, is that possible? Because LACO has developed so well over the years. And I know that people were very excited when he took over the reins and to again guide it through, say, the exciting times that we're faced with. From a health point of view, from a well-being sense, you can never underestimate the value of good quality music. And we've seen over the last few months how certain orchestras have put together certain forms, have actually used the technology that we're using now to actually put performances mm-hmm. together and so on and so forth. Thankfully, there's always good recordings of Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra that you can actually listen to from that. But there's still something to be said for that special, unique experience of actually experiencing the audience, and the audience experiencing the orchestra in the auditorium, which it's actually made for.
Yeah. Yeah. And the unfortunate reality is that that is something we can pine for. We can see that as a light at the end of the tunnel. But that is not feasible in any way in the near future. And so our view is, instead of pining for that and bemoaning the fact that we don't have that, instead, let's accept that as a fact, albeit an unfortunate one, and think about how we can best serve our mission and serve our goals. And how can we best leverage the resource, the technological resources that we are, that we have, that are abundant in our pockets, and on our desks, in our homes? How can we best leverage those resources to capture that thing that you were just describing, that that indescribable alchemy of live in-person music making? And so what we're exploring is, what can we do that is digitally native, that is not just a recording of a concert, but that if you sat in the concert hall and experienced the taping, you would actually be missing out on something that is captured in the digital format. And for us, what that is at this point, it's still, we're still figuring this out, of course, a lot of organizational competencies being built in real time. But what we've touched on is, musicians, as you well know, communicate volumes while they're performing through just their eyes and just their body movement. And so by using the magic of cameras, we're able to get you, the audience, in a place that you would never get to be in a concert hall, and get to see the musicians are wearing masks. So in the same way that when you lose your sense of sight or your sense of hearing, your other senses are augmented, we are keenly focused on what's happening with the musician's eyes and communicating with one another. That has been, even for someone like me, who I've been immersed in classical music my entire life, you get to see something new and something, it may be a piece you've heard before, but to see the musicians communicating so rapidly in real time in these very subtle ways, that's something you don't get to experience in a concert hall in quite the same way. So that's one small example of how we're exploring making the best, truly, of this situation in which we find ourselves.
Yes, certainly. I'm mindful of the fact that many of the great composers whose works you feature, as Johann Sebastian Bach, Mozart, and so on, even in their historical period of time, they wouldn't have been faced with this particular system. This is very much, it's become a cliche to say, unprecedented. And as you, I think you're absolutely right to make use of the technology to work through that and to develop it. I was just interested, in terms of you're talking about eyes, I wonder if any musicians, sometimes they look heavenward and think, oh my goodness, what's happening now? They made another wrong note, etc. But of course, that would never happen with the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, because it's a seamless production. So that's great.
Yes, there's the thought.
Exactly. So you've talked about some of the kind of the ways forward, and we'll talk hopefully in part two, which will come around, etc., about the upcoming performances and things that are there.
Yeah.
From your own perspective, how have you psychologically coped with the challenges that have been faced by actually, you know, the state of California effectively going under lockdown and then coming out of it, going back in, and all the challenges that you've been faced with there?
That's a really good question. For me, I lean on and draw inspiration from the areas of this art form that that bring me the most joy. I think joy is in short supply in moments like these, especially as you were saying, going in and out of lockdown. Those kinds of transitions are particularly jarring when you think, oh, things are getting better. Oh, no, they're getting worse. We're in this period of unknown. Oh, wait, things might be getting better, or they're shutting down again. That is so exhausting emotion for all of us emotionally. And then when you layer on top of that what's happening here in America and around the world, I know, the incredible unrest, social unrest that we are grappling in America with, generations of systemic racism coming to light in ways that for privileged white people like me, we're just now starting to kind of understand and grapple with, and to have that layered on top of this pandemic is a really toxic mix. And so again, joy is in short supply. So I lean on the places in my life where I derive joy. And that, of course, is classical music. That is art. Generally, of course, we can't go to museums anymore. So I listen to a
come to Britain. We've opened up some of the museums. You can come over here.
Oh God, I would love to. I also, and you know, this is a silly thing, but I have my father's turntable that he bought, you know, in the mid 70s, and I recently upgraded my speaker system, and so I have derived such joy and meditation from the act of putting the records on the turntables and sitting without my phone, without my computer, and listening to this incredible high fidelity music just wash over me. That's something I think in moments like this, we tend to issue those moments of meditation because there's so much turmoil and so much unknown. Our shared enemy is the unknown. And so taking moments, just for me, taking those moments of quiet meditation are of paramount importance and clear a path in my little brain to tackle this work with LACO, to tackle this challenge both one day at a time and also open space for us to be strategic and try to envision and imagine what our future could look like, knowing that the path is likely to deviate multiple times and we have to be okay with that.
It certainly seems as though we've been welcomed to the 21st century in full force, really. And again, a whole range of interesting times coming through with that. We were speaking to our Florida correspondent, Mike Dooley, recently, and he did say, we need, like yourself, to focus on this as being an opportunity, to actually see it as possibly birthing pains, changing to adjust things, etc. I'm sure we will actually get back sometime to where we were, but at the same time, in certain instances, as you rightly said there, Ben, maybe we don't want to go back to where we were. Maybe we do need to think about the kind of things that are actually important. And we don't want to simply go back to what we perceived as business as usual, because there are so many times where, whether it be climate change, whether it be issues relating to BLM, any of those sort of aspects, it is critical we acknowledge them and don't simply say, oh, well, don't worry, it'll all pass. We'll go back to where we were.
That's I couldn't agree more, Alex. And I think on a couple of those points you touched on, we in classical music have been talking about the need to evolve our digital relevance, the need to become more inclusive and diverse organizations, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it objectively makes for better art. We've been talking a lot about these things, and there have been glimmers of progress in at LACO and in other organizations, but overwhelmingly, we still have a lot more work to do. And so, again, the word opportunity is maybe problematic because I don't want to make it sound like we're taking advantage of this genuine
coronavirus pushing you forward, pushing
crisis.
You to a brave new tomorrow.
Exactly. But what it is doing is forcing a conversation in our industry that is quite frankly long overdue. And I completely agree with your assertion that we're not going to go back to business as usual. We will go back to the concert hall. We will perform. There's no replacement for that experience you articulated earlier, sitting in a concert hall live, experiencing that miraculous transaction that happens. But we will be different organizations when we return, when we are able to return to the concert hall. We will be fundamentally changed and for the better.
And I think that'll probably also apply to a lot of the other industries in Los Angeles and indeed in the entertainment industry throughout the world. Ben, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today. It came a little bit earlier than I was really anticipating, but that's good. That's fantastic because, as we've said, in the sort of pre-interview chat, etc. Hopefully we'll have part two where we focus more closely on how the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra are going to be focusing on some great events in the very near future. But I do need to ask you those last two questions, at the moment at least. Ben Cadwalader, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Very interesting. Yes, thank you, Alex. I really enjoyed this conversation. I look forward to our next one.
In which case, as I say, you've already answered the second question. We can look forward to connecting with your good self for the second part of this piece in about a week's time, all being well.
Indeed. Looking forward to it.
previously in the Ben Cadwallader sequence of interviews that we focused on, we were talking about how it felt to actually join the LACO, the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, as their executive director, literally just a couple of weeks before, clearly, the whole coronavirus aspect struck. This week, he's back with us again to actually share some of the magical things he's doing. He's working closely with music director Jaime Martin. And we've also got the wonderful television director extraordinaire, Graham Harper, with us. Graham, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Looking forward to this.
Excellent. And Ben, it is great to see you once again. And we've got our time zone sorted out. I think if memory serves, depending on when you're listening to this, obviously, it's now coming around to about 11:30 a.m. in Los Angeles.
Exactly right. Yep.
Fantastic. Graham, you've had a look at some of the work that Ben has been involved with and what he's actually doing. And obviously, we've been listening to some of the fabulous music that the LACO produce. Any initial questions you'd like to put to Ben at this start, at this stage?
I've got the three areas. Whether we discuss them all today is up to you. I'm very interested in three aspects. One is the funding of what you're doing because of lockdown or coronavirus. So you mentioned various people who are funding this. That's a lot of money, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. The other area is Florence Beatrice Price. I've listened to some of her music. I didn't know it. Studying this for today, I listened to some of the music, and the symphony number one in E minor is just beautiful. And then you hear about a little area about how racism then plays a huge part in her not having success, I suppose. I don't know. Yeah. That's what I'd like to hear about. And there's another one, but I doubt we'll get to that. So should we just stop me there?
Yeah. Ben, which one of those would you like to go for first?
Well, we could spend the whole time talking about either one of those, but let's start with your first question around funding. That's a very astute question. And you're absolutely right. That's a huge consideration in this, of course. LACO, like most, if not all, American orchestras, relies very heavily on individual contributions, which are tax-deductible contributions, charitable contributions to our organizations. And as a result of that, we have a very large. Oh, did we lose him?
No, Graham, are you there? Hopefully, he's still there. Yes, he's still with us. Don't worry.
Okay. Okay, he's back. Okay.
Here we are. I don't know how far you got with me there.
Okay. So, because of our reliance on individual donors for contributed revenue, we have a really wide range of audience members who are also almost like investors, individual stakeholders, financial stakeholders in the organization. So, when we are faced with existential threats like the coronavirus pandemic, we can rely on this wonderful groundswell of support that we have from our donors to enable us to do things like the Summerfest. And I think one of the things for me that's been really instructive in this is when we first started thinking about doing something over the summer, of course, the first thing on my mind was, okay, these are all great ideas, but how the heck are we gonna pay for all this? And so when I floated the trial balloon out to some of our donors, among their first questions were, are you going to be paying the musicians in full? No special discounts or anything, just are you paying? And when we said, well, yeah, of course, great. Then they lined up in support. Of course, they're supporting LACO, but they're also supporting these individual artists who are really painfully hurt by this pandemic, very seriously hurt. So we found that by putting our artists at the heart of the discussion of how we're moving forward, that's been really successful in generating increased sponsorship, increased support, and also bringing in some new funders as well. I'll give you one very quick example. For the Summerfest, we have one concert that we've already broadcast. It's currently available on demand at LACO at Home. We have another one coming on this Saturday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. But after that first broadcast, we went into this, the whole summer was not funded. We knew how we were funding the first two, maybe three concerts, but for the rest of the summer, we didn't have funders lined up for that. By the time Monday came around, the broadcast was on Saturday, but by the time Monday came around, the whole summer was funded. So that one broadcast, people saw that. They were so impressed by what they saw. I had longtime audience members who commented on the closeness that they felt to the musicians. These are people who've sat at Laco concerts for decades, and they said, I've never seen the communication that happens with their eyes. Because, of course, they were all wearing masks, so you really have to focus on their eyes. and so over the weekend, I was on the horn with donors, and again, by Monday, we had the whole summer filled. So our hope, Graham, is that is a microcosm of what we would like to see for the fall. We have not announced it yet, but we are planning to present a season next year. Of course, it's not going to be of the magnitude of what we had originally presented, full orchestra concerts, et cetera. It will be smaller ensembles, but they will be presented digitally. But when we talk about revenue that's associated with those concerts, we believe it's not going to be ticket revenue, what we would call earned revenue, in exchange for goods and services. It's going to be available for free, but that those concerts are going to be subsidized by generous contributors who want to see musicians at work, who want to continue to see Laco presenting the kind of high quality, innovative performances that we're kind of known for. So that's kind of where we are now. The summer is kind of a test of this larger and brand new, in so many ways, model for how Laco presents concerts.
Can I ask you another question, Alexis, as well, interrupting you? When musicians come together, they're going to be in Zimmer Hall?
Zipper Hall, yeah. That's the Colburn School in downtown Los Angeles.
What am I saying?
Zimmer Hall is in Bournemouth, Graham. It's where very elderly folk actually go.
So when they're together, because of the having to keep so separated, is that, I'm not a musician, so is that difficult for musicians to now play together? I guess not. I can imagine you're going to say no, but is it difficult being in a place like a venue like that, but being separated enough so you can obey the rules?
Yeah.
And at the same time, when I see quartets and quintets and orchestras, they're all together, very tight. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's important. That's the first question. The second is, what's it like to play music when you've got no audience visible and physically there? Does that have an effect on the way you play, or are you so in the zone it doesn't matter?
I think so. Your first question, and I think I can safely speak on behalf of the musicians here. We actually had a very interesting conversation at the last taping about this very issue. When you see the broadcast on Saturday, you'll see a clarinet quartet, so string quartet plus a clarinet, and two violin, cello, and clarinet, and they are spread across the stage, socially distanced. And one of the requirements that we have is that wind players, because of course they cannot wear a mask while they play, they are in what is essentially a three-sided plexiglass phone booth, is what it looks like. He's surrounded on all sides by plexiglass, and so there are very real acoustical ramifications to both the distance between these four players, but then also having our clarinet player, Josh Rands, in a plastic box has further negative impacts on what happens acoustically. So much of chamber music, as you both well know, is reacting in real time to the musicians that are immediately to your left and right. It's very different when you're separated by, 30 feet. So we had a conversation about that, and I asked them, what spurned this for me is they were having conversations about, gosh, we don't feel like we're quite gelling, we're quite connecting. I, sitting out in the audience, I was hearing it too. But fascinatingly, when I went into the recording booth and put on a set of cans and listened to what was happening with the professional mics, it sounded great. They sounded perfectly together. And I thought, what the heck is going on here? So went out and we had a conversation, and we thought, should we experiment with earbuds so that we have a sense of, so that we're not relying 100% on the real-time oral feedback that we're getting in the moment, and we're partially connected to the mix, to the audio booth, but it is another skill set that our musicians have to deal with during this time. These kind of subtle differences, especially in chamber music, make a huge difference. A lot of our musicians are also studio musicians. They play on, you know, big Hollywood movies and TV shows. They're used to playing with headphones, but this is a different competency. The difference may seem subtle, but it is significant, again, especially with this kind of really intimate chamber music. And then your second question about no audience there, I think any musician will tell you that one of the great joys of performing is the incredible energy, transaction of energy that happens with the audience, the applause, and also in the moment, knowing that you have this sea of bodies out there hanging on your every note. It definitely feels different in the room. Now, what I just said sounds negative, and there are certainly negative sides to that as well. But on the positive side, it can feel more intimate and more joyful. In other words, there's a difference, I think, when you pull together a group of musicians who love each other, who love playing together, and they are doing it in a formal capacity for an audience versus gathering in their living room and playing their favorite pieces for the sheer joy of playing. And so I'm an optimist, and maybe this is just me being a relentless optimist, but what I feel sitting in the hall, and what I hope comes across in the videos, is that we are privy to this really special and intimate moment of joy between friends and colleagues. And that is actually not something that you get to experience in quite the same way. You don't get to be in the musician's living room during this really intimate musical moment. And that's something that I hope is being captured in these videos, because it certainly feels that way when you're in the space. So pros and cons to that audience, lack of a real audience.
Does a musician, sorry, Alexis, no? I'm coming back. You'll get in a second.
Okay.
Do you, when you're playing, so like I come from the acting side of performance. So when I was a young actor, I could feel an audience. I can't tell you whether it made me any better or because I was terrified most of the time.
But does
an audience make you emotionally play better or find new moments within the way you play? Or does that make sense? Or is it so structured that the audience doesn't have an effect, but you just enjoy playing?
I think I wish one of the Laco musicians were here to speak, because I don't want to speak on their behalf, but I do think it's two very different experiences from the musician's standpoint. And I think to directly answer your question, yes, I think the presence of a live audience, that buzz that you felt as an actor, musicians feel that too, and it brings a different level. Maybe level is the wrong word. It brings a different type of artistry, a different energy into that unique alchemy of live performance. But again, I think that there are two sides to that. I think there are myriad positive benefits to that, and I think there are also positive benefits to playing in a quiet, contemplative, controlled space, as I just said. So I think, to be clear, if the musicians were here, given the choice of those two, I think 99% of musicians, of artists generally, would say we prefer to perform for a live audience.
Yeah.
So that needs to be said as kind of the backdrop to the whole thing. Of course, that is the preference. Musicians love to share what they are making live in real time with their audiences, in person, with that wonderful crackling energy feedback. To suggest that what we have in this digital realm without an audience is inferior because of the lack of an in-person audience is something that I think, and this may seem paradoxical, but I think the musicians and I as well would reject the idea that what we are offering without an audience is inferior because that energy isn't there. I just think it's a different experience. And again, I hope that it feels more intimate. and more special, being able to see, be part of that incredible immediate transaction and communication that's happening between musicians. That's not something you get to see even sitting in the front row at a classical music performance.
Yeah.
I'll just briefly interject at this moment because Tara Bennett, who's another one of our Los Angeles correspondents and the editor of SFX magazine, she's currently embedded with the Disney company writing the full unexpurgated behind the scenes of Marvel Studios over the last few years. But she's actually said something that she did say, pass this on to Ben, please. Tell them to keep up the music. That's Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. The arts are getting us through.
Yeah. That's wonderful to hear. And that is exactly the type of thing too that our musicians need to hear. Because as I said, artists are really suffering in this, especially here in LA. The major studio work has all but dried up. It's just starting to come back in dribs and drabs. But thank you for that. I have a monthly meeting with the entire orchestra. That's just me and them on Zoom, just checking in, no agenda. And I will mention that to them on Monday, because that goes a long way. Graham, I want to go back to, you had a second question about Florence Price. And if it's all right, I'd like to address that quickly as well, because that is I'm so glad to hear you say that, because one of the things that is so important to us at LACO, to our musicians, and I know to the classical music world writ large, is that we take full advantage of our uniquely privileged positions and our voice with our audiences to bring to light musicians, artists like Florence Beatrice Price, who, due to systemic racism, were just kind of pushed out, were never given a voice, not because their voice is inferior, but because of the color of their skin. And by programming a piece, even a small piece, it seeks to accomplish exactly the journey that you articulated a moment ago, Graham. Hey, that was a beautiful piece. There were some wonderful creative harmonies and intricate construction of rhythmic patterns. There's a lot going on there. Let me listen to this other piece. And then that first symphony. Yeah, there's a lot going on there. And so one of the things that we have restated as a priority and elevated institutionally to hold ourselves accountable is that when we program, we continue with the beloved, dead Europeans that we all know and love, but that alongside that, we also elevate voices like Florence Price, and there are a number of living composers of color and female composers who have wildly creative voices, who we want to bring not just to our audiences, but to our musicians as well. That's an incredible opportunity for LACO, for our field. And I'm glad to see that LACO is not the only place that's doing it. We have a lot more work to do to kind of catch up. And I'm glad to hear, Graham, that was in this specific instance effective with Florence Price. She is marvelous.
What was interesting was listening to the two. I only listened to the two pieces you mentioned in the document I received. What was fascinating, my wife said to me, "Don't dare say what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it."
Graham, please.
No, I know she'll tell me off. But what was fascinating for me was in her music, I heard Gershwin, I heard Summertime. In the desert, what's the desert song, is it called? The Deserted Garden.
The Deserted Garden, yeah.
If you listen to that and you listen to Summertime, Gershwin's Summertime from Porgy and Bess, it's not summertime, but you can hear the soul of that song.
Yeah.
You can hear this. If you listen to the her first symphony in E minor, it's Gershwin, and it's not Gershwin. Did Gershwin, did he get something from her? Did he listen to her? But there's an affinity between these two, and yet they're very different. I mean, she's one of her own.
Yeah, yeah. It's really special. She is. It's uncommon to see an interweaving of musical traditions in such an effective and really innovative way. You know, Gershwin does this brilliantly. In my view, Florence Price does it just as effectively, if not more so, than Gershwin. Those are her roots. That's the music that she grew up, she was steeped in, applied to this more, you know, classical convention that yeah. we're more familiar with. And it's done really, really effectively. One of our, on that same note, Derek Spiva Jr. is a living composer with whom Laco has a long relationship. We actually recently promoted him to our artistic advisor to help us think through some more creative programming options. He himself is a wonderful composer. Like Florence Price, he is able to weave together musical traditions that perhaps at first glance seem like they wouldn't play well together. I'll send you a link when we hang up to a piece that Laco commissioned that we were supposed to premiere this past spring, unfortunately had to be canceled. But we did this wonderful video mashup with Laco musicians and some dancers that gave a 3 to 5 minute clip of what that piece would have been. It is brilliant. And I can't wait to bring it to life on the stage, but there's so much untapped opportunity and potential. We need only use our platform to give light to it and bring it to the front.
Oh, it sounds good.
The sense I'm getting is the energy, the dynamism, which we knew was actually there. But I think, Ben, what you're doing is really getting that passion across. It's no surprise you're clearly the go-to person to take over as executive director back in March for Laco. Graham, I think we've got just a few minutes left. Did you have a third aspect you wanted to just address?
It's just a question about the musician who's going to do a little jazz moment, and I want to know what that piece was going to be.
You're talking about, I think, David Grossman, the bass player?
Yes, that's it, yeah.
Yes. It's funny, David and I were actually just emailing about this a couple days ago, and he's actually still deciding. I gave him a couple ideas, a couple suggestions, and he is still deciding. So I am waiting with bated breath, as are you. And as soon as we have that, it'll go live.
What I found interesting there was that amongst all these wonderful pieces of music buried, you've got jazz. And to me, there's no difference. Jazz compositions are as equally important to be played alongside great classical pieces, or what we would like to call classical pieces. I don't think Florence I don't know her name so well enough. Price. I don't think she's classical in the vintage kind of 18th century and 17th century style of classical music. It's very modern, but it's still classical style music. It's beautiful. Jazz can be that too.
Yeah. Hey, a quick question for yourself. Sorry, Ben. Yeah. Ben, go ahead.
I was going to say quickly, you're right, and if you have an ear for classical music, the rhythmic and harmonic complexities, that same ear can be applied when you listen to jazz, when you listen to Coltrane, when you know, it's almost like if you have an affinity for scotch, if you have an affinity for fine wine, you're going to be able to apply that same palette to a really complex IPA. A good beer, you know. And so I think when we put these next to each other, it makes for a really delightful and juicy listening, listening experience. And that's what we're kind of experimenting with a little bit on this summer series that may impact some of what we do into the fall and beyond. So. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Alex, what were you going to say? Sorry.
I was just going to say, Graham, in all the hundreds of TV shows that you've directed, and clearly I think the orchestral aspects of Murray Gold in your Doctor Who series and so on, listening to the music of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, are there any areas there where you thought, actually, this would really suit this particular format, this particular program? And is it something where, I mean, I'm looking at how we can get a deal here between your next directorial project and the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra to actually get together? That's the line.
Now we're talking.
It's not me you have to talk to. That's a producer and the company, and they will have a big say in that. So the answer is that I would love to. Now, when I'm listening to music, or when I'm working on a project, a production, I can hear in my head the kind of music I would love to accompany a scene. And I think most scenes should be able to play on their own. They don't have to have music. But sometimes music doesn't give you, it's a third dimension. It gives you the inner thought, the soul of the scene again.
Yeah.
And it can set the scene for you or the emotion. So when I'm hearing music, I often think, oh, I'd love to have used that, or I would like to be able to use that when I'm next doing a big action piece or a big romantic moment or whatever. Does that make sense? Rather than a composer, usually you're lucky enough to have a composer who will watch your production and you both decide where you want music and why you want it and what it's got to do.
Mm-hmm. But in that instance, it sounds like the film is influencing the music.
Yes.
Are there any instances, Graham, of when the music has influenced the film? In other words, where you've heard a piece or you've heard a composer and thought, oh, and that has changed your perception of what you decide to shoot?
No.
Or changed how you do the scene?
No. We've got another hour. If we had another hour, we've got lots.
Got another 5 minutes. We'll squeeze it together.
I love this.
Because I'd like to tell you a story which you haven't got time for. With Roger Lim, who was an electronics composer. He used electronic instruments to play for Doctor Who in the 60s, well, the 70s and 80s. Now that's gone out the window. Now it's big orchestral pieces with orchestra.
Right.
But when I was starting directing, I happened to be lucky enough to meet a guy in Birmingham, here in England, not in Alabama, who decided to do a program all about, you all know this, Alexis, in the 60s and 70s, there were no pop videos. So there was a lot of pop music around, obviously during the 60s, masses of songs that didn't have any video that went with them like we do now.
MTV wasn't around.
So he decided, let's invite directors and give them two pennies, and they, with that little amount of money, they can create pop videos. So the music then, so we were allowed to choose from 20 or 30 pieces of music. We could choose two or three of these and go off and make, for so many pounds, we could go and make a pop video that might have been suitable for that at that time. And that was the music then was definitely influencing the visuals. And I loved it. What a lovely idea that the music drove it. Whereas now, of course, when I present a production to a composer, the scenes that he's looking at are instigating the music.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. That would be fun to explore. We don't have time.
We'll have a third session, Ben. We need to work that through. I need to plug, obviously, Mozart's Clarinet Quintet, of course, July 25th at 5 p.m. Pacific Coast time. That's taking place as part of the LACO Summerfest. And indeed, for those folk who are looking for some of those decomposing composers, Johann Sebastian Bach and Haydn are featured on August the 8th. At 5 p.m. again, Pacific time from that point of view. Lots of highlights there. LACO.org is the go-to website to find out details from that point of view. Gentlemen, I think it's been an awesome session, really, in many ways. We've brought together London and Lincoln and Teesside and Los Angeles in a magical way. I'll come to you first, Ben. Have you had a reasonably interesting second Zoomer with us on the program today?
Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure, Alex, and I hope we can continue the conversation. I really enjoyed speaking with you both.
That's excellent.
Thank you.
And Graham, has it been good for you?
Yes, it's been excellent. I wish we had more time.
Well, then we'll obviously have to deal with that wonderful illusionary nature of time. Actually, Ben, I do need to mention that there's also another famous Pennsylvanian soul that we featured quite regularly a few years ago. Academy Award-winning Shirley Jones also came from Pennsylvania. So obviously, roots in Pennsylvania, it's got a magical thing from that perspective.
Nice.
Ben Cadwallader, Executive Director for the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra and BAFTA award-winning television director Graham Harper, many thanks indeed.